Welcome to The Poet's Voice, a program dedicated to the place of poetry in our lives and communities. This program is supported by America's Hometown Laureates, Inc. I am Plymouth Poet Laureate Miriam O'Neill, and today I'll be interviewing poet Eileen Cleary, whose collections Child, Ward of the Commonwealth, 2 A.M. Keats, and Wild Pack of the Living have earned much acclaim, the latter of which was a Mass Book Award finalist. Besides writing poetry, Cleary is also the co-founder and editor of Lily Poetry Review and Lily Poetry Books. In her other life, Cleary is a hospice nurse, and that work often informs her poetry. Today, we'll hear from Cleary about the power and place of poetry in her life.
Well, thank you so much, Miriam. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. And so I'd like to start with a question about whether or not you could tell us, share a short poem and tell us the origin story of the poem, how it came to be.
Sure. I'm going to read The Interstate Spills, which just came out in Panegyrus. As Stevie's captor sets up shop to sell Bibles or broken TVs, while his real dad stops fishing at the lake and camping with his kids near Bear Creek Bay, the target moves whenever a lawful neighbor smokes out Kenneth Eugene Parnell. Who can say what a boy hides between stones in his pockets? The barred owl's baritone gives way to the tiny engine of morning cicadas in Dell's village of grieving, waking his rooms truer than steamed coffee, filtering the black and white photograph of his boy in Wranglers and cowboy boots outside of Charles Wright Elementary, door of an ear against a cool sheet. There might as well be asters in his feet. How long? What is soon but a country with open borders, impossible to know who will pass through or when? For now, a cardinal trills life, life. Soon the wind through honeysuckle, hornets shying outside their paper nests next to a ladder set out since yesterday's rain. This poem appears in my book, Wild Pack of the Living, and it just gets at the emotional resonance of having a child abducted and a little bit of the narrative experience of both Stevie, the boy who was abducted, and the father.
Thank you so much. So many images and so many leaps between images. The flowers, his feet may as well have been asters, just gorgeous. So thinking about the power and the place of poetry, who introduced you to poetry and when did you start writing? Can you tell us what it meant to discover poems and writing them?
I've always loved poetry and to read it, to hear it read, and I always had a sense from an early age that I could write it. But I never really wrote it seriously until I wrote a poem in grad school related to some unethical research on human subjects. And I was a different person when I reached the end of that poem. I could never go back to being a person who didn't write poetry. I was changed because my inner world was allowed on the page, I think, and I was able to translate it and make sense of it a little bit more. And then I realized I couldn't possibly go on in life without continuing to express what translates myself to myself, I think.
Thank you for that amazing answer, translating yourself to yourself. We'd like to know, how has reading and knowing other poets and their poems contributed to your understanding of the poetry and of your own work?
Oh, thanks for that question. I think we all rely so heavily on the conversation we have with other poets, both on and off the page. And I always love talking about this. I think on a universal kind of biological level, poets always receive calls, and we respond to them, to that input, by writing poems. From something as simple as feeling cold or putting on a coat, we're constantly calling and responding to the world. And in art, this kind of elevates itself into a conversation. A poet or an artist calls out to another who in turn responds. And one of the highest callings of the poet is to read deeply the work of other poets. And luckily for us, poetry flattens time and it shortens the distance so that in a single poem in 2023, say, a person can talk or walk with Keats among the river sallows in 1819 and simultaneously sit in a rarefied ghost garden with Lucy Brock-Broido in 2018. We actively enter another's work, engage and respond and call each other across the centuries. Beyond that, I believe that we can have relationships on the page. And my calling as a hospice nurse allowed me, for instance, to comfort John Keats over a century ago. And I think the other part of the question is what I do with the work of other people and how it informs my writing. And editing has allowed me to appreciate a wide aesthetic beyond my own. And there are so many extraordinary poets, a privilege always to enter their work. And that, but when I edit a person who is struggling to translate themselves on the page, and I'm able to turn some type of key that allows that to happen, that's the most exciting thing for me, because that's what I hope will happen to me in my own work. And it illuminates not only their work and their book, but provides tools for me to continue translating myself.
Thank you so much for that answer and for the reference to editing other people's work, because even if we're not, as writers, we're not in the position of being an editor in a publishing format. So many of us have the opportunity to see other people's work and make comments about it or respond to it in a way that helps that person open up their work and in turn teaches us about what we need to know about our own work. Absolutely. Absolutely. So thinking about poems and their shapes, are there any elements that you feel like you lean on in your work? Anything in particular, whether it's alliteration or repetition or anything like that?
I think the highest thing that I land on when this is said, other than the most essentially concretizing everything I can possibly concretize, the thing that I rely heavily on is allowing the words in the poem themselves to decide where they belong. I don't know. I think the poem lets itself be known and shows itself on the page by its need for white space. White space is the force in almost all of my poems. It's the mortar that holds it together and holds it apart when needed. For instance, even little tiny amounts of white space between parentheses become little alcoves where I can go and collect myself or while speaking as the speaker. And words in the poem can be completely off the page when you think about white space in that way, but their presence can be between the words in the stanzas as well. They can be in the margins. They can be off with the reader, even. And I've found that if the poem speaks authentically, uses the art of, like, arranging words for sound and syntax and music, imagery and tone and lexicon, but as true to the space it is meant to inhabit, that the poem works for me. And I think also poems have to be empathetic. They have to be compassionate for me to enjoy writing them. And I think they come alive when they're most authentic. I always say that when you can hear the horse neigh on the page, you know that the poem has come alive.
Oh, I love that. I do love especially your reference to the white space. And personally, I've always thought of the white space as making room for the reader on the page.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the ways, because if you pick up a poem and it's jam-packed and there's no air in the physical thing on the page, to me, that feels like a disservice to the reader. The reader doesn't have a way to dwell
in.
With.
There's no, you know, if every stanza is a room, there's no room to walk from room to
from
room.
From room to room.
And no elbow room at the table, so
excellent.
To speak.
Excellent. Well, I'd love it if you would read us, share with us some, a few poems of your own and let us know where they came from.
Sure. So that original poem that I read earlier in the conversation with you was a poem from Wild Pack of the Living, which is a book about a boy named Stephen Stainer who was kidnapped in Merced, California in 1972. And I think what I would like to do is read a poem from that book that it tries to explain why I had to write it. If Stevie were never taken, I'd stop seeing the parkway where red ball gas persists long after it closed for business. The service clerk sponging the windshield, dusty as a country road, could finally retire. If I recognized Stevie sluggish in the back seat, I'd see where the sedan-spectacled driver, nearly hairless, hyperglycemic, haphazardly eluding capture, must be fleeing. And I'd pursue him, learning by heart his license plate and face, the hard years of his years, his wintering. I'd rid his Buick's trunk of its church flyers with fake monks, shred the ruse he printed to appeal to the gullible and plain old religious, everyone with a young son. I'd gag his give to the poor Mrs. Jones and Mr. Bean. He's out of Grimm's with sleeping pills spilled in the console coursing through Yosemite. If he leaves no tracks on the packed ground of Tioga Pass, who can follow where he crossed into the camp? I can't think because of the cabin I'd be forced to tour. I might have to touch, not a monster per se, more like eyes torching dry leaves in fire season. And since poetry is a conversation, and I want the conversation to go on, I'm writing a new manuscript, and it concerns the myth or the fable of Red Riding Hood, but in a more realistic sense. What would happen if this child survived? What would she go through? How would the course of her life take itself? And so I might finish with a few poems from that manuscript. First of all, in this book, before there was a once upon a time, there was a pond of time that was more romantic, less traumatic, and Red misses that. Once a pond of time. Hummingbirds lined dandelion nests, and Red's every puddle held the plump moon. Dragonflies tattooed their silvered histories onto the water's skin. Tadpoles budded into verses and leapt onto lily pads where lyrics rose and fell like breath. Mm. Before a pond, there was a pond. Before grim reeds swayed to a feral wind, before monk-like minnows cast last light, before her kingdom of cattails closed into night. And this is an abecedarian, which every line begins with a letter of the alphabet in order. And this is abecedarian, Red's trial preparation, special victims room, 5 months post-discharge from the pediatric ICU. Accompanied by her nurse, the girl, barely audible, whispers, "Hi. Can you tell me your name? If ever you don't know the answer, just say so, okay? Every toy in this room is okay to use. Is that your favorite animal? Mama gave me this bear. Do you know why we're here today? Red fingers the rope-like scar on her neck. I got hurt. Do you remember that day? Just a little bit. You aren't in trouble. I know I am. I said, aren't, sweetheart, you are not. Red looks to her shoes. What happened wasn't your fault. Where's Mama? You'll see her soon. We wanted to tell you Wolf will be his own lawyer in court. And he'll ask, nobody else saw you in the woods that day, right? Only you know you were alone. In the cabin, did you push away? Did you say no? And harder questions. You petted me at first, liked my fur, asked me to follow. Why didn't you run? Did you stay because you wanted me? Did you scream or just lie there? I couldn't, my voice was stuck in my neck. Try your best to answer yes or no. Unless you'd like to, don't look at him. Your victim advocate can sit next to you in court. Oh, and Wolf will ask, what were you wearing? Weren't your snacks there to lure me? Explain what you were doing in the forest. Didn't you trespass on my property? Zigzagging through the woods like that, what did you expect? And I'm going to read Red 30 seconds after. Her heart pumps its bled water to the bitten apples on her dress. Atop soaked sheets, she hears paw thumps on the hallway floor. Shivers, winter in her gnashed skin. Is that rustling in her head a claws rake or adrenaline? Is that door creak him leaving, or will he lunge for her again? And I like to think that eventually Red recovers and has somewhat of a beautiful life, and she's on her way in the process of the manuscript now. But the other thing is that she also, I believe, lived, as we know, the story is an old story, and she's lived centuries later. So the last poem I'll read is called Red Centuries Later. Though no one will tell you, the robin appears at 2 a.m. cloaked as a woman. Look, otherwise you'll miss her. You'll wonder where she'll appear, but not how to distinguish whether she's the one. There'll be no footprints on the path, just an orange coin by an oak limb that, aside from its lilting voice, you'd confuse for a small moon. She's humming a song for the living. She's quoting herself. I am obliged now to refrain from dying. Forget her earliest catechism. Her veins brim ichor, and the goddess in her loosens her hair.
Well, thank you so much, Eileen, for those stirring poems and a whole way, new way of thinking about Red Riding Hood. And I'm looking forward to this book when it arrives in the world.
Thank you so much.
So we'd love to thank you, Eileen Cleary, for talking to us about your work. And we'd also like to thank our audience for joining us, listeners. If you'd like to follow our program, remember to check your TIC listings for future broadcasts of The Poet's Voice. This is Miriam O'Neill. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.